This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
And Glenn Holt. And this evening on Queer Voices in News Wrap, from This Way Out, there has been more violence against sexual minorities in Middle Eastern countries. But here at home, several states have taken action to affirm GLBT rights, including Vermont, which became the fourth U.S. state to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples, and the first to do so legislatively. At 9:40, we'll take a look at the Houston Transgender Center with Kristen Williams of the Transgender Foundation of America. In the second hour, the gay author of Whose Song and Other Stories, nominated by the American Library Association for their Best Gay Lesbian Book of the Year Award, Thomas Glav, will be interviewed by Joan Devlin. And we have feature segments from This Way Out and something new. You can follow along now as we run the show by going to queervoices.org and then link to Facebook, that's the Queer Voices site on Facebook, or the Queer Voices site on Twitter. You can do that through queervoices.org. And I will be posting our music playlist as we play the music and the names of our guests. And I will be doing that on Twitter tonight during the show. And we're sort of kind of waiting on Ray Hill. So
yes, he's getting out his broom. And he'll be here shortly.
And we've entered the 21st century, haven't we?
It sounds like it.
We get to Twitter. Isn't it Twit People? Is that what it's called?
You tweet.
You tweet. Okay.
See how old-fashioned we are? We don't even know the terminology
for
this stuff.
I think I'm thinking of Twit, the old
this
magazine we have. Yes.
Well, you know, we were going to talk about this in the second hour, but a lot of things happened this past weekend. And a couple parties and events. And
a lot of things that happened. Matter of fact, we had several of them on our show last Monday. And I know that Brian had gone to...
Actually, since Ray isn't here right now, why don't we go to this to News Wrap from This Way Out?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 11th, 2009. There are reports this week that at least six Iraqi gay men have been brutally murdered in the past 2 weeks in Sadr City, a Shiite-dominated slum district of Baghdad. Some had the words pervert or puppy, a derogatory local word for gay people, written on their chests. The New York Times said as many as 25 boys and men suspected of being gay have been killed in the past 2 months, citing police authorities and friends of the dead. Some may have been victimized by death squads associated with Muqtada al-Sadr, a radical Shiite cleric with significant influence in Sadr City. Major portions of Friday prayer services conducted by his followers have reportedly been devoted to railing against homosexuality, but a police official who declined to be named said many of the murders have come at the hands of family members committing so-called honor killings fueled by their shame over the victim's sexual orientation. Whatever the numbers, there's no doubt that gay men are being terrorized, but both Iraqi and U.S. government officials have denied that there's an organized sexual cleansing effort going on there. A Sadr City cafe frequented by gay men also recently burned down under mysterious circumstances. Consensual adult gay sex is a crime in Iraq, punishable by up to 7 years in prison. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch were among several global advocacy groups expressing concern this week over increasing violence against gay men in the country.
According to various news reports, Morocco's government has launched a crackdown on the so-called promotion of homosexuality, saying it threatens religious and moral values. The Interior Ministry has promised that such activities will be repressed. The move is apparently in response to the increased press and broadcast coverage of gay and lesbian issues and same-gender couples. The ministry denounced media outlets that defend ignoble behaviors that constitute a provocation of national public opinion and fail to take account of the moral values and doctrines of our society.
Two Moscow Pride organizers were convicted this week of promoting propaganda of homosexuality to minors. Nikolai Baev and Irina Fett, along with two other activists who were not arrested, had carried banners that read, "Homosexuality is normal," and "I am proud of my homosexuality," near a school and library in the Ryazan city center. That's about 200 kilometers, or 120 miles, southeast of Moscow. The action was a deliberate challenge to the local region's 2006 law that prohibits any discussion of homosexuality with minors. It's the only law of its kind in Russia. The court fined the pair 1,500 rubles, about $50 each. They promised to appeal their convictions to the Russian Constitutional Court. Moscow Pride has six cases already pending before the European Court of Human Rights, challenging the local government's repeated ban of LGBT rights marches in the city, and an additional case against Russian President Dmitry Medvedev for refusing to intervene.
But Vermont became the fourth U.S. state to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples this week. Marriage equality legislation had passed overwhelmingly in the Senate and by a significant majority in the House. A two-thirds vote by lawmakers overrode a veto by Governor Jim Douglas. That was a certainty in the Senate, which voted 23-5 for the override. 95 House members had supported the original bill, but 100 were secured in that 150-member body to dramatically override the veto by the bare number required. The override made Vermont the first state in the country to establish marriage equality by legislation rather than through court order. The new law goes into effect on September 1st. California lawmakers have twice passed marriage equality bills, vetoed each time by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The state Supreme Court issued a marriage equality ruling last May, which was overturned by the passage of Proposition 8 in November. The High Court is expected to rule on a constitutional challenge to that popular vote by early June.
Iowa's Supreme Court, just the week before, unanimously ruled that the Midwestern state's ban on same-gender civil marriage was unconstitutional. High courts in Connecticut and Massachusetts have done the same. Neither the governor nor Iowa's legislative leaders have expressed interest in overturning the High Court ruling. Any attempt to do that couldn't be made until 2012, and only through an agenda item at a voter-supported constitutional convention following its approval in two sessions of the Iowa legislature. State officials announced this week that gay and lesbian couples can begin marrying in Iowa on April 27th, a few days later because of budget cuts, they said, than originally announced.
The Washington, D.C. City Council voted unanimously this week to recognize same-gender marriages conducted in states where it's legal. The 12-0 vote puts the council on a collision course with Congress, which has oversight of the city's laws under home rule. Procedure requires a second council vote next month before the measure is reviewed by federal lawmakers. Minority Republican Congress members have already condemned the action. The city passed a domestic partner registry that raised the hackles of the GOP in 2007. Openly gay council member David Catania called the recognition legislation part of a march toward human rights and equality.
Colorado Governor Bill Ritter this week signed the Designated Beneficiary Agreement Act, which allows unmarried adult couples, including same-gender partners, some of the legal rights of marriage, including inheritance, medical decision-making, and hospital visitation. The law permits any two unmarried adults to designate each other as beneficiaries by filing a form with a county clerk. The legislation takes effect on July 1st. Two openly gay members of the legislature, Senator Jennifer Viega and Representative Mark Ferrandino, both Democrats from Denver, sponsor the legislation. It passed with minimal Republican support. GOP Senator Scott Renfro quoted from the Bible during floor debate and called homosexuality an offense to God. Viega objected to the comments. "I will stand here today and tell you that God also created me," she said. "And the last time I checked, I am who I am."
The City Council of Columbia, Missouri this week unanimously approved a domestic partner registry for same-gender couples. Heterosexual couples who choose not to marry can also register their partnerships. Couples must have lived together for at least 6 months. Each partner must also be unmarried, at least 18 years old, and mentally competent to enter into a contract. While the registry doesn't offer any specific legal rights, it could be used as proof of a relationship at local companies that offer health insurance to its employees' domestic partners. The registry had the support of Mayor Darwin Hinman and the Columbia Human Rights Commission. One speaker during the public hearing before the vote received a standing ovation from the gallery when he made an impassioned plea for passage. Retired United Methodist Reverend Dick Blount told the council that, "These, my brothers and sisters, are the last group that has not yet been given what is their right. That is all we're asking for," he said. "We're not trying to make the issue complex."
And finally, a new TV ad attacking marriage equality hit the airwaves in selected U.S. states this week, but its tone might be more appropriate for Halloween, and its content perhaps for April Fool's Day. It's called The Gathering Storm, with actors portraying self-avowed heterosexuals who are frightened by gay and lesbian couples getting married. The ad includes cheesy special effects with wind-driven dark clouds and occasional lightning bolts in the background. A group called the National Organization for Marriage is reportedly paying more than $1 million to put the ad on the air. The actors variously describe pro-lesbi-gay developments that they say threaten their religious freedoms. The LGBT advocacy group Human Rights Campaign used its website to expose each of the claims in the ad as outright lies. The group also discovered audition reels of actors seeking a role in the ad and posted them to their website, too. Here's how openly lesbian commentator Rachel Maddow reported the story on her MSNBC cable show this week.
Human Rights Campaign, the gay rights group notable for not having the word gay in their name, has pulled off a coup in their counter-organizing against a group called the National Organization for Marriage. The National Organization for Marriage is itself notable for not having in their name the phrase, "We mean just straight people's marriages." The National Organization for Straight-Only Marriage is running a new multi-million-dollar ad campaign warning about how scary it is for gay people's relationships to have legal recognition. Here's a little bit of the ad.
There's a storm gathering.
The clouds are dark and the winds are strong.
And I am afraid.
Spooky, right? Spooky. Human Rights Campaign has done a good job refuting some of the gay marriage ruined my life stories that are in the ad, but they've also gone one better, somehow obtaining video footage of the people who applied to pretend that they were straight people who had been somehow hurt by gay marriage. These folks have been referred to elsewhere today as actors. I'm going to withhold judgment here and just let you make that call.
Okay. There's a storm gathering.
The clouds are dark and the winds are strong.
I am afraid.
Some who advocate for same-sex marriage have taken the issue far beyond same-sex couples. The storm is coming. But we have hope. A rainbow collision of people of every creed
and color are coming together
in love to protect marriage.
We do not know how Human Rights Campaign got access to the audition tapes, but because they did, we do know that pretending to be a straight person hurt by gay marriage is apparently very, very challenging.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 11th, 2009. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
This is Queer Voices.
Can you imagine having gay people in an advertising agency to be able to get something like that?
Well, you know, actually someone emailed me an advance copy of Rachel's story. Rachel did the voiceover in my logo piece, and so we chummed up in that process. So I got the email, and then by the time I tried to download it, there was a flag up that said, "Due to copyright consideration." From the anti-gay organization, they had temporarily pulled that down. And so apparently they got their copy off of Rachel's show and carried it alive for this night's program.
Well, it's really interesting developments with the fact that there are now four states that you can legally marry. And the last one was Vermont.
Well, Iowa was the one that they that the courts did it. Vermont did it electorally. And that's important.
Yes.
Because the legislature did what the legislature is supposed to do on an issue where the legislature do that sort of
thing.
They
overrode a veto by the
overrode a veto. And that was amazing because they were five votes short of overriding the veto before the veto. And then overnight, those five votes magically appeared, which I thought was a remarkable bit of organized, you know, having been in those kind of situations before, to conjure five votes between the popular vote and overriding the veto is enormous.
Well, it's really interesting because there was an op-ed piece in the Times on Sunday saying that the Supreme Court probably won't touch this because they don't want to get their hands in something as controversial as this, you know, let the state sort of
I'm in a struggle to eliminate executions. Texas is a very execution state. And now we have two new states joining the We Don't Execute Anymore group.
And what states are those?
New Mexico and New Jersey have just joined. And they did it legislatively in both cases.
Really?
And to eliminate that, so we now have 14 states in the United States that do not practice executions. Of course, Texas is the most executing place in
yes.
the world, so I'm
mm-hmm.
watching this issue very closely. And I don't think we need to get all the way to 25 or half the states. The Supreme Court seems right on the verge, even this mm-hmm. conservative
wow.
Supreme Court, on the verge of ruling executions as cruel and unusual because a clear majority of the court pays attention to what happens in other democratic societies. And we're the only democratic society on this planet that executes people.
That's pretty incredible, and especially as much as they do in Harris County.
Harris County is, if Harris County were a separate state, we would be number three.
Wow.
But we have got a new district attorney. And
what do you think of her, Pat?
Well, you know, I didn't vote for her, and she knows I didn't vote for her, but she is... I don't know if I can say this on radio, but she's got more balls than the two guys that preceded her.
Yeah, yeah.
She's standing up for principle in a very courageous way. We would not have heard a peep out of Johnny Holmes or Chuck Rosenthal over an assistant DA eliminating every potential black juror on a panel. We would not have heard a peep out of them. And she called my office and said, justify this. And when they did not do a very good job of justifying that, she took further action. She listened to what they had to say. And we've got a situation where a police officer in Bel Air has been indicted
right.
for shooting people.
Right.
Now, that case is very dear to my heart because I went through the recent timeline published in Outsmart and all of that. And there's not a word in there about Fred Pies, but the assassination of Fred Pies by a Houston police officer was an enormous part of our historic evolution because Fred Pies was very important to the movement and his loss cost us severely. And so I nurtured that police execution of a gay activist through indictment. It took me a year to get him indicted. Then it took another year for it to come to trial. And he was ultimately acquitted. I mean, the officer, Kevin McCoy. Kevin is now in North Carolina running a racist organization. Surprise, surprise.
Mm-hmm. Go figure.
Scratch a homophobe and find a racist. Isn't that amazing? And so I keep up with him. I still have Fred's telephone number, and I still have Fred's post office box. I'm not going to get over that. I'm going to live a long time, and I'm never going to get over that one.
Yes, that famous phone
yeah.
number.
You're right.
Yes.
And everybody, they treat me differently now, for the most part. I go to occasional task force meeting, and there have been a couple of things that I really want to talk about, because we went to the leadership meeting, which is an outgrowth of the conference on the futures, and that is working as it should. People get together. We don't have any officers, and we sit around and we talk about hopes and dreams and aspirations, what organizations are doing. People can stay informed. And if you're out there and you're in a role of responsibility in any organization, I want to encourage you. There will be another one in another quarter.
We meet and four we'll times announce here. It here. It's a quarterly meeting, so it'll be 3 months from last Saturday, approximately. Yeah. And unfortunately, Tim wasn't there. Tim Brookover, because
we missed him. He's been kind of the guiding spirit of that. But we did well without him. We covered somebody. I am concerned that we, our community, as a whole, socially and certainly politically, and in concern of some hazards, are not keeping up with the technology. The bar business is way down. You go over and talk to people, and the bars have got to think of some real seductive events to seduce people to go to the bars. Mm. And
well, I'm wondering, Ray, if that is not just if it's that's a generational thing also.
Sure.
The fact that a lot of younger people don't feel that they need the bars as much as we did.
Yeah, well,
and the bars weren't just for drinking.
Well, that's
but
true.
They were a social gathering.
They were oases in a madness.
Yes, they were our churches. Yeah,
they were oases in a madness. And see, I've been sober for 50 years. I've got to carry a 50-year sober and alcohol and drug-free chip in my pocket. And I went to bars to politically organize. So I spent most of my adult life not drinking and organizing in bars, because that's the institution where we gathered. That has shifted because of modern technology and our progress. Because, you know, there are openly gay people in every neighborhood in Harris County. I've wondered when that would happen, like in the trailer parks on C.E. King and all of that. But
Rainbow lives in a trailer park.
Well, Rainbow is a pioneer in that area. And there are other gay couples that live there. I visited a gay couple, and they had their friends over, and they were dealing with, you know, counseling women in straight divorces and dealing with abusive husbands. And it was a wonderful gathering. But, you know, these are gay people. We can spill our guts and talk about our relationship problem because they're immune to those problems.
Sure.
But okay. but the cruising needs of the male drive have not changed significantly among younger men, because sexual prowess and proliferation is identity related, and gay males are not that much different from straight males in that regard.
As we're talking about younger people, you're certainly aware of this thing called sexting, aren't you?
Yeah.
Where young people will email a picture of them, you know, and this is not gay necessarily.
No.
A gay thing.
No, it's just,
but they end up being sexual abusers or.
Sure. Well, the internet is an interesting phenomenon.
Yes, it.
The internet breeds an absence of candor that concerns me, and it's beginning to show up in the STD statistics. I am. Disease-free is easy to put on a website, whether that is true or not, but the recipient is likely to believe it, and so we're seeing an increase in internet age connections. And you know, not everybody is not what they appear to be on these search sites of trying to find
the famous New Yorker cartoon is
right.
A dog. They don't know we're a dog. You know, I'm a dog on the internet.
Yeah, right. and so people have a tendency to have more equipment, better equipment than they say they have. They tend to be richer than they are. They tend to be younger and better looking and better built than they are. And then what you get is what you get whenever you show up. But that also affects things like HIV status. And a lot of these people are very sexually active, and it affects other drugs and other kinds of STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. I am concerned about that culture because there is currently no effort in that culture to address this lack of candor. I see a poster in the elevator whenever I go to the Montrose Counseling Center that deals with the age of consent problem that is involved there. You know, anybody who is 14 years old, alone and horny, and is in love with you is fat and 50 and a police officer. If you haven't figured that one out, then you're slow to get it. But apparently a lot of people haven't figured that. At least one cable network does that show almost every weekend.
Yes,
people.
Yeah.
And it's not just gay people, but it frequently is gay people. And so there are hazards out there. And I'm not saying this to scare anybody, but there have been three recent homicides that there is evidence that internet connections are how the victim met the culprit. And so Uncle Ray, who's been around the block a time or two, is here to tell you that if you're involved in that culture, be careful. Things are not what they appear to be. And here is helpful hints. Do not meet anyone in your home.
Exactly.
Do not meet anyone in a very private place. If you're going to meet somebody with whom you have connected on the internet, go to a public place where you know people. So people you know will see who you are with.
Mm-hmm. The bar might be a good location.
And another technological thing that has come along are cell phone cameras. That's important, to have a picture of strangers that you're going to be vulnerable with. So use your cell phone. You don't have to make a spectacular. Just take a picture of you together or something. That is actually not in the cell phone. It is reserved in the space that you own with your cell phone company and can be conjured up lately. And it wasn't until the third homicide that I asked the detective, is there a computer in the apartment? And he said, she said, yes. And I said, seize it. We need to look at that hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're the culprit out there listening to us, we are coming up with enough technology that you're using to do your ill-done deeds, and we will use that technology as a defense mechanism as well as the mechanism that you're using. And if you're a potential victim, listen to me. Not everything someone tells you on the internet is accurate. Check it out. And I have not had unprotected sex with anyone since I wrote the pamphlet in 1982. Do the arithmetic. And I'm not as active as I once was, but I'm better than I ever was, so there. but the deal is that we need to get back into a mindset where we are concerned about ourselves and one another, both in our dating habits, in our politics. And what if there was another Paul Broussard killing? How would we organize now? We don't have a newspaper.
Well, yeah.
Facebook.
Facebook. But is anyone actually... I mean, I'm on Facebook, but I wouldn't have a hint. I'd have to call a wizard to come tell me how to adapt that for that purpose.
You can ask Brian here.
Yeah, Brian's a wizard. And Brian, help me think about these other things. How do we strategize in the interest of people's safety, both in meeting up with strangers and how to prevent HIV?
I think it's all a matter of common sense and education and being aware, you know, and realizing that there are a lot of lies on the internet and people will do anything they can to get what they want.
Shouldn't we be there saying that?
I think so, but I think...
How would we do that?
There's a couple of awareness campaigns. I know that Legacy is doing one for internet chats, trying to make people aware.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I saw Eric today.
Oh, yeah.
And Eric, we coffee up every once in a while. And I know Eric has got his heart in the right place. But maybe some of you wizards need to coffee up and strategize, getting a little more aggressive with that, because I'm very concerned about people's safety.
I think we should definitely do a segment on that. And if anybody has some expertise on that, please email me, jack@queervoices.org, or tweet us.
Twitter us.
Let us know, because definitely I do want to talk about that. And also I want to talk about organizing. And yes, you know, we have our web pages and stuff like that, but it is Facebook and Twitter and
have I got time to mention there's a new march in the planning?
Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, march has started actually right here in Houston. We were probably about 30 minutes ahead of Harvey Milk announcing Harvey Milk's idea to have a march in 1979 because of the way the clock works in Houston and San Francisco. And we announced it at Town Meeting 1, and you saw the movie. He announced it at the rally. It wasn't part of the movie, but that rally where he shortly thereafter met Briggs, he made the announcement of the National March on Washington. It was mentioned in the movie. And then Harvey got assassinated, and I wound up being the chair of both the executive and the coordinating committee. We had a major conference in Houston where we came down here to devour one another and scratch one another's eyes out. And amazingly, when it was over, we were of one mind. And we managed to get about 100,000 people to Washington, D.C., and you have to get that many to be noticed. But it was a successful thing. And then we did it again in 87, and then we did it again in 93, and then we did Stonewall 25 in 99, and then there was the Millennium March. And the Millennium March was so disappointing because it basically became a march movement for the profit of a single organization and a handful of people who made a lot of money off of it. And so now they're talking about it. You can go to National March on the internet, just National March for Lesbian and Gay, Transgendered and Bisexual Rights, and it'll pop up in your search engine. But the organizers have been in communication with me, and I said, look, I really don't want to fight a march for profit thing. I did that, and I didn't enjoy doing that because it brings about division. And they said, oh, no, we're going to protect the grassroots nature of this. And so I checked them out with old grassroots activists in New York, people whose name you wouldn't recognize, but I know have made major contributions to our history, like Steve Ault and Joyce Hunter. Men and women who have given and given and given, and they're as old as I am now. And we compared notes and said, yeah, these kids are of grassroots mentality. So get ready to go to Washington. Of course, I suppose the big thing will be marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, and I brought this up at the meeting on Saturday, is that, yes, that's an important thing to do, but we don't even have any basic rights here in Texas or in the city.
We don't have any protection in Texas.
And we're talking about employment, housing discrimination.
Those issues are a lot less sharply felt when a majority of even Texas corporations, I think Exxon is the last holdout of the major corporations headquartered in Houston.
That's right.
That do not have They have a policy statement about job protection, but they're not on board with spousal benefits and things of that mm-hmm. nature. But the other major corporations in Houston are doing a remarkable job, and some of that's pretty surprising. I mean, for instance, people who put out oil field fires have got spousal benefits.
Isn't that amazing? Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And and who would have thought that these oil companies, who used to be the redneck companies and the macho companies, yeah. all except for ExxonMobil, pretty much have sure. non-discrimination and partnership benefits?
Well, you know, somewhere down the line, you have to figure out that Shell actually belongs to the royal family of the House of Orange and Royal Dutch Shell, and you know, Wilhelmina and her ancestors and predecessors and heirs and assigns. We're not anti-gay, you know. I mean, so you've got that one, and all it takes is one major competitor to do it, and then report back. Wait a minute, this didn't cost us a damn dime.
Well, and you still have the sad part about that is ExxonMobil. It's the Exxon of the ExxonMobil. Because yeah. Mobil was very
GLBT-friendly. Before the merger, and the people that had protection under Mobil before the merger still have protection. Mm. It's the new hires that don't. And there's another interesting thing that was on the news this evening, and that is the focus on the Family Guy. That religious nut from Focus on the Family. I'm sorry, I have some trouble with some of these names. Focus on the Family Guy has said, "We have lost the culture war.
Oh,
send money."
I don't think so.
We've lost the culture war.
I'm glad to hear that.
Send money. We'll think of another one soon.
Is he waving the rainbow flag?
Well, I mean, even in their advertisement, a rainbow coalition, where do they get that kind of language? rainbows are all white now. or do you run it through a prism so it breaks out into a spectrum of colors?
So, Ray, what are you up to lately?
Well, if it weren't for the poverty and the crippled old man crap, I would lead an absolutely charmed life. I get more attention than anyone would ever deserve. My show on KPFT is now world renowned. They're going to show the documentary about my work with prisons on Channel 8 on Thursday the 30th.
The Independent Lens?
Yes.
All right.
No, it's Territory this time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've been on Independent Lens. This is Territory screening. And if you're listening to this in other cities in town, check with your local PBS station for the screening. But it'll be on all Texas PBS stations.
10:30 p.m. on the
10:30 p.m. on the 30th. And I'm excited about the feedback that I'm getting from that. We're launching a new program. We're not going to do a national march on Washington for equal rights for former offenders, but we are going to do a manifesto, a collection of 12 theses or more, if necessary. We haven't decided. And about next January, February, we're going to go staple them to the front door of the new Attorney General's office.
Oh.
Like Martin Luther did in the Reformation movement. I think that's an interesting media-creating gesture. But the deal is that we need a lot of reforms, a lot of issues affecting prisoners. And let me tell you something. Right now, this is Queer Voices, right?
Right, it is.
Right now, there are hundreds of gay inmates in Texas prisons listening to the show on this station, and this is their only connection. Other than my being so openly gay on the prison show, this is the only light they get. But guess what? Because of the excellent job that you do carrying the national news and talking about located topics, they're some of the best informed gay people in the state. And I want to say hi to all of them.
Hello to y'all.
And I get to go in. I went recently in the continuing education forum done by the AIDS Foundation for our Wall Talk program, which teaches inmates what they need to know about HIV and AIDS, hepatitis C, and safe prisons. And a lot of the volunteers in that program are gay. and the rest of them are kind of gay friendly because that they deal with those kind of issues in dealing with that. And I'm very proud of working with Texas Department of Criminal Justice and the AIDS Foundation in helping institute that. And it's now been doing it over a decade now.
Great.
And so we're preparing people in that way to get out. And I want to tell you all that you're valuable people. I overcome my number. You will be able to overcome yours. And you have talents and skills and other things to offer to a deserving world that needs you and those benefits. And I'm not going to take up any more of your time because I know you've got a show to do here. But I love you. I love this show.
Well, thank you, Ray. And
you've got to come back. We've got to get you back on here.
Well, periodically. You just ring a bell. And I am so irrelevant that sometimes I forget my own schedule.
I know. That's why we have cell phones. you can listen to Ray Hill on KPFT at 9 p.m. on Fridays. And you have a website, right?
We have a website that's theprisonshow.org. And we have a new program. If you have HD capacity on your radio, or you can go to your computer. Every time Texas does an execution, and they're going to do one on the 15th at 6 o'clock that day, Elizabeth Stein produces, and I am the talent, and we have a legal authority in. We study each case execution. We spend an hour on that while the execution is in progress. If there is a stay granted, we don't do a show.
Okay, that's on HD2.
HD2 or executionwatch.org.
Thank you, Ray. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Coming up next on Queer Voices, Kristen Williams of the Transgender Foundation of America.
I don't want to ride this roller coaster. Think I want to get on. They buckled me down like it's the end of the world. If you don't want to have this conversation, then you better get out, cause we're climbing to our death. At least that's what they want you to think. Just in case we jump the track, I have a confession to make. Something scream out quite so loudly when we screech to a halt. I'm just never prepared for the end of the ride. Maybe we should get on something simpler, like a giant balloon. I've got 2 tickets left, so do you. Instead of giving them away, aching romance.
is Matt Albur, and from a 2008 CD, Hide Nothing, the title of the track, The End of the World. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Lavinka.
And we have on our phone tonight from San Francisco, Kristen Williams, who is Executive Director of the Transgender Foundation of America. Kristen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you for being so patient. We were having our own difficulties time-wise.
Howdy from Texas.
Hi, how are you?
You're going to be back in town tomorrow, aren't you?
Yes. I'll be there tomorrow, and I'll be in Houston until the 27th.
Well, the last time we talked, when the center had just opened, there was a lot of ifs and uts about plans for the future. And first of all, tell us about the Transgender Center first, and tell us about it, and we'll ask about what the future holds for us.
Okay, well, simply put, the Transgender Center is, a project of Transgender Foundation of America, and this is where our offices are in Houston, and it's also where we do a lot of our work, and we have an archive. Lots of transgender groups use the center for meetings. Lots of professionals use the center to provide low-cost services to transgender people.
Now, it has its roots, though, in an effort to work with transgender homeless shelter, wasn't it?
Well, yes, absolutely. All of the efforts that you see going on today come directly from, the older efforts that I was involved with Community Awareness for Transgender Support and the homeless shelter down in Galveston, Texas, and all of those things that were going on in, the late 90s, early 2000, 2001, 2002.
Now, for some of our audience, now I happen to know the information, but some of the audience may not know that most homeless shelters won't take transgender people, will they?
I didn't know that.
No, absolutely not. In fact, all shelters in Houston and around Houston and in the Gulf Coast refuse to take transgender people simply because they're transgendered, and it's perfectly legal. I have a heartbreaking example of this that just, it's something that will haunt me, I think, to the day I die, when our effort with the transgender shelter down in Galveston, when it folded due to lack of financial support, the night that we were meeting as a board to decide that we, make it official that we were going to close the shelter, an individual came up to me. We were meeting at the GLBT Center for this business meeting, and she walked up to me and said, "My God, y'all are the people that have that shelter. I need someplace to go." And she started listing off the shelters, the various shelters that had turned her away. And of course, I had to say, "I am so sorry. The shelter is closing, and there's really got there's no place for you to go." And 2 weeks later, she was walking down Lovett Boulevard, and someone drove by and shot her in the head.
Oh my gosh!
Oh my God! Well, and that goes to another point with transgender people, where the transgender community is more likely to be killed. Just because of who transgenders are.
Why do you think that is?
Why do I think that is?
Well, why do both of y'all? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that on a certain level, I think that gender stereotypes, a lot of people base who they are as human beings on gender stereotypes and their ability to stay within the confines of gender stereotypes, and when they see someone violating a gender stereotype, they take it personally. Most of the murders that you see, they aren't just, simple killings. They're very personal killings, a shot to the face,
mm-hmm.
or several shooting, several gunshots to the abdomen, or taking a baseball bat to them, or disfiguring them.
Or several dozen stabbing.
Yes, it's very, very personal when, generally speaking, whenever a transgender person is murdered, it's really, I think,
vindictive.
An effort yeah. on that person to erase that gender nonconformity. And I think sometimes we see that when they mutilate the genitalia.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Center that's opened here in Houston, tell us a little bit about the center itself.
Well, the center is located in the heart of the Montrose at 713 Fargo, and it's kind of a Victorian building, two-story, and upstairs, downstairs, it has a professional space for people, for service providers who are willing to give or provide services to transgender people on a sliding scale basis.
Example?
For instance, we have, there's Dr. Lynn Shepherd, who will see people on a sliding scale basis, and will see them at the transgender center. And she's able to use those our professional area, and we will work with her clients and support them in seeing her. And so the client gets to access care that they might not otherwise have. The service provider gets to access a good supportive environment in which to deliver their service. And the flip side of all of that is, generally speaking, especially if we're working with a client who isn't able to pay anything, that client pays for their service by giving back to their community by volunteering. So, for instance, there's a group, STAG, and which is some transgenders are guys. This is a support group for female-to-male transgender people. And they noticed that some of their group members were having a tough time buying medications. And so we work with that group to ensure that their members are able to get their medications in exchange for providing volunteer hours back into the community at large or at the center, just so long as, the person receiving the service, they're giving back to their community. The group is involved also, so that the group is focused on addressing the needs of their group membership. It's this wonderful give and take that's going on at the center.
Well, that's an excellent way. That's a great idea. Now, you said earlier that the groups meet there. Is there facilities there that you've set up for different organizations to meet?
Yes. We have a rather large room upstairs that a lot of groups use. We have smaller areas downstairs where people meet. And generally speaking, because it is a transgender center, our policy is that any group, activity, event, anything that goes on at the transgender center, that it must in some way improve the quality of life for transgender people.
Excellent. Excellent mission statement. What do you have planned for the future for the center? And I know that we had talked the last time you were on the show about the future and future possibilities. Can you give us any information on that now?
Well, certainly. In the future, we have plans and goals to be able to take what we're doing in Houston and export it to different cities. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I'm here in San Francisco, is doing some some evaluation of San Francisco to see where San Francisco is at, and if they would be able to basically support that the community is at a point where it would be able to support a center, and if not, what needs to happen. So there's absolutely that aspect going on.
That's very interesting.
And here at Houston, what we're trying to do, and let me kind of backstep just a bit and let you know where I'm coming from personally. Some of my background, a substantial amount of my background, is in HIV prevention. And so a lot of the interventions used in HIV prevention are evidence-based, meaning you execute an intervention, you study it, you look at what doesn't work, what does work, and you fine-tune it. And then at that point, when it's fine-tuned and you've proven that your intervention works, then you can export it to different organizations, locations. So that's, in fact, what we're doing in Houston. We're fine-tuning what we do to be able to then export that to different locations throughout the nation.
Is there a possibility at any time there will be a homeless shelter for trans people?
Yes and no. In fact, that whole issue has been resolved.
How so?
We worked very, very, very hard for a long, 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 long time. Right after the shelter closed, the work on homelessness in the transgender community didn't stop. If anything, it picked up. What we learned from the transgender center folding is absolutely we need some resources there. That whenever it comes down to it, it can't be such a grassroots effort. Meaning, we have to have the kind of support that comes from federal grants, specifically like from HUD. And so we worked very hard for a long time to work with the Houston Homeless Coalition to do things like stand up and publicly question the Secretary of State, the Secretary of HUD, as to why they have a practice of funding facilities that specifically exclude transgender people, doing all that stuff for a long time. A couple of years ago, a fellow by the name of Joe Fuentes from Houston Area Community Services and I worked together on a grant for a housing program for transgender people, and that was funded. We recently found out that was funded, and so in September, the transgender community will have its own homeless program, and it's not a shelter. In fact, a lot of that kind of that focus on homeless shelters is being shifted towards something called Housing First, meaning before someone becomes homeless, you intervene in that process so they don't become homeless. Well,
that's terrific, but aren't some of the homeless youth?
Or if they are homeless, you immediately put them into housing. And,
got it.
And the flip side of that is, there at the Transgender Center, we also have this thing called the Transgender Task Force, the City of Houston's Transgender Task Force. And that is, we partnered with the City of Houston to form a task force to specifically kind of function as a watchdog group for service providers. So we have a list of providers who are receiving city funding. And so what we do with this task force is we look at the providers who are receiving city funding, and we look at the contracts that they have with the city to see, you know, of course, if they are in fact abiding by those contracts by excluding transgender people and not providing adequate referrals. And if so, well, they're actually jeopardizing their funding.
Yeah.
How
effective have you been?
Well, this is something that is just getting off the ground.
Okay.
We've met three times, and this Wednesday we'll be meeting again. City officials come to these meetings, and the community is welcome at the meetings. And so it's a group of people that looks at all of this data. You know, part of that is to do some secret shopping, mm-hmm. so that people walk in to these service providers and present as being transgender to see what happens.
Okay.
And follow it up by someone who, you know, doesn't fit that stereotype of, quote, transgender, and see if they get services. So those are all the kinds of activities that's going on at the Transgender Center.
Well, give us your information. So if people need to contact you or would like to contact you or the foundation or the center, can you give us that information?
Sure. The phone number is 713-520-8586. That's 713-520-8586. It's open Monday through Friday, every day from 1 to 4. Those are kind of drop-in hours. That's also the hours in which you can go and view the transgender archives and the historical items that we have there. The website is TG, as in transgender, TGCTR, which is the abbreviation for center. So it's tgctr.org.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much. We've been talking with Kristen Williams, Executive Director of the Transgender Foundation of America and the Transgender Center here in Houston. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew. I don't care, but there's
there's more to this even I can bear.
Keep going.
That was Phil Dutra from a couple of years ago, an album called Right Behind the Rain, actually an EP, an extended play, and the title of the track, Another Day Alone. This is Queer Voices. And every so often, we have the pleasure of having Joan Devlin join us on the line from Iowa. Joan used to live here in Houston and be a regular part of Queer Voices in the studio. And now Joan is perched out there among what I like to call the fertile cornfields of Iowa. Joan, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you, Glenn?
I'm doing good. And the kitty that I gave you is still doing good?
Oh, yeah. He's right here. He just dragged his toy up in my bedroom.
Okay.
Up on the bed next to me because he thinks every time I'm on the phone I should, you know, like a little kid, he likes to bother me.
Right.
So
who do you have as a guest this evening to talk to?
Play with him. Yes, we're going to be talking to Thomas Glave, who is the author of The Torturer's Wife, among other books. The Torturer's Wife is actually his latest book, and it is quite an impressive work. Thomas, are you with us?
Hi, yes, Joan, I am, and thank you very much.
I just wanted to talk to you about this book because the theme, well, I don't want to say there's a common theme because there's very many differences in the stories, but one of the things that is, I guess, apparent in several of the stories is people trying to survive the unsurvivable and obviously not always able to do it. What was it that made you kind of want to explore this theme?
I think that many things in recent history have really propelled me to think about these themes, that is to say, war, dictatorship, political violence, national violence, historical violence, these kinds of things, right? And how indeed do people as individuals, which are always the characters I see first, individuals, not political themes, but people living in political contexts, how do they survive these things that, as you say, are indeed unsurvivable? And what are the complications that come up for them in looking at these moments in their lives?
And what I think is interesting is you explored this theme from a variety of viewpoints, you know, from the political revolutionary to the person in the village that's just quietly living their life one day when their world literally explodes, to someone who's actually in a safe place. The main story, the story that the book is titled after, The Torturer's Wife, this individual was not in any danger whatsoever. But the reality of what her husband was doing was too much for her to bear. And that was her, I guess, burden, was how to survive the knowledge that she was married to someone that was literally killing women, you know, by the thousands.
Women and men, yeah. And children.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how hard was it to kind of get in the heads of these different people in these types of situations?
You know, I think it was not as difficult. That was not one of the more difficult things, I think, actually getting inside the characters' heads, because often, indeed, those characters came to me as voices, and I really heard them. I felt inhabited by them. I think that at some point with some of them, some of the challenges that came up were remaining as true to those voices as possible. That is, really hearing them and hearing what they really wanted and what they were hoping for, and not trying to impose my own desires on them, but letting them really be who they were and do the things, sometimes terrible things, that they felt compelled to do. I think also that the things that happened for some of them later were often surprises, you know, for me in the stories themselves. I didn't always know what was going to happen. And so that was interesting, but also at some points difficult, because I didn't want them to do certain things that they ended up doing, as in the case of, for example, The Torturer's Wife, which, of course, I won't talk about on the radio, because I'd like people to find out for themselves what happened in that story. But, yeah, it was all very, very fascinating for me, just seeing what these people were going to do in these very, volatile moments.
What I like, too, is that in a couple of the stories, you actually were, I would say, more than one character. That is, you presented the same situation from two different individual viewpoints. How difficult was it for you to do that? And especially in the story about the two men, Jay and Jonathan.
Oh, Jonathan and David.
Yeah, Jonathan and David, which is very biblical. But, you know, the, Jonathan and David, who are two very different men from two very different backgrounds who are in love in a place where that's not even safe to think about for a variety of reasons. And you kind of had to get into both of their heads and explore the relationship from very different, you know, cultural viewpoints. How difficult was it for you to do that?
That actually was extremely difficult, I must say, that particular piece in making that come together, because I recall feeling this kind of agony as the piece was progressing, because I was dealing with a kind of technique of providing information, but at the same time not wanting to provide too much information, because as you know, having read the story centers on these two guys who are clearly of different races, right? And yet we never know which race either one is, and we don't even know what colors they are, actually, racially speaking. So I was forced to really, what I wanted to do, of course, was really provide a lot of information about them and how they felt and their secret most anxieties and reflections, but at the same time not reveal too much that would then provide an absolute clue as to who might be which or what. And what was interesting for me about that project in particular, that many things were quite fascinating about that story for me, but and remain so, but what I was really struck by was how similar their language became in terms of the negative things that they said and thought about each other, yeah, in terms of the actual bigotry that was exposed. And yet, here are two men who, from all appearances, as far as I could see, really loved each other.
Well, that is another theme that's kind of explored throughout, because in the last story in the book, in which a gentleman is having to deal with basically the hate crime murder of someone who is a friend of his, he is also at the same time dealing with an attraction to another man, and he too is having those bigotry issues around skin color, even though technically they are of the same race. Well, so he's kind of going through this whole process of wanting this man, but at
Solomon,
the same time
yeah.
mourning his friend and feeling the fear, because the very thing that he wants is what got his friend killed, and it's very complex. How hard was it to go through all those themes?
Well, that story was, of course, as you say, you know, they all have different motivations in the creation, in the actual development of the tales. But that story was something that I wanted to write, I think, for a very long time, set in Jamaica as it is. And my background, of course, culturally is Jamaican. But I have never seen anything like that in Jamaican literature at this moment, contemporary Jamaican writing, nor in anything of the past. And I wanted to write about the background that I knew as somebody from a Jamaican middle-class background. I was born in the United States, but I grew up in the U.S. and in Jamaica. And I grew up in a very middle-class context in Jamaica, and that story reflects, of course, the middle-class context of the principal character, one of the principal characters, Aston, the man you're talking about, who has a desire for Solomon, who is a working-class, poor even, actually, fisherman. And Aston, at the same time, is mourning the death of his friend Carlton, who is maybe more of lower middle class, not quite as upper middle class as Aston is. And I was really interested in exploring that whole very stratified class structure that we experienced and we still experience in Jamaica in terms of conspicuous consumption and all that. But at the same time, to think about the skin color issues between us as black people and how we manifest these bigotries, these beliefs about skin color, and how they're connected to sexual desire and romantic longing and all this kind of thing. And I'd never seen, as I said, a tale like that that dealt with all of these things, and I wanted to really look at that very carefully. I mean, violence, desire, love, longing, mourning, and, of course, fear, right, throughout all of it.
Now, all of these stories, though somewhat similar in theme, are, I mean, very different. You go from, you know, the hull of a slave ship in 1791 to, as you just talked about, modern-day, you know, Jamaica, both Kingston and St. Catherine, which I guess is a small rural town.
Paris, St. Catherine, yeah.
I mean, you go South Beach, Miami, 1992. I mean, it's just all over the place. How, as well as dealing with all the characters, how hard was it to kind of move through all these times and places and centuries?
I don't think it was very difficult, because I do have, I must say, I think if I say so myself, a pretty voracious imagination. curiosity is probably a better way of putting it. I mean, I have a pretty voracious curiosity, and I want to know a lot of things. And these stories really began with questions about what would it be like to be in this situation, right? Or what would it feel like to feel that? And again, when you mention the story that takes place in 1791, for example, He Who Would Have Become Joshua, 1791 is the title of that piece, I, again, never saw a story like that. And as far as I know, nothing like that story exists anywhere in the literature that we have at hand, the literature of the U.S., the literature of the Americas, black literature, writing by white writers or other people, nothing, in which you have two men living in an African village who are then dealing with the possibility of being enslaved and in the transatlantic slave trade, but who are also romantically involved with each other, who are actually lovers in pre-slavery Africa. And I was interested to see what that would be like, certainly to write that story and then to have it there to read. And so that was one very powerful motivation. But I think that the characters themselves, as I said earlier, you know, when they come to me in these various voices and manifestations, then that compels me into writing the tale. And then, of course, the technical problems that come up, the technical questions that come up are different than the actual genesis of the story itself.
I have to say my personal favorite was South Beach, 1992, and I really admired the way you were able, I mean, it just took me right back to 1992 and the struggles the community was having both internally and externally around the issues of AIDS and people with AIDS and the fact that back then AIDS was a death sentence. And it just, you know, it was really striking to me how you were able to just so easily go back, because, you know, you get caught up in your own time.
Yeah.
And you tend to forget that, hey, there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, when AIDS was a death sentence, when people were afraid even of their best friends and especially their partners when they found out they had HIV. I mean, so to me, that was just really brilliant, the way you were able to just kind of transcend time that way.
Oh, thank you. Well, I just want to say quickly about that story that I do remember that I was working in AIDS education in that era, in that time, and I was also doing volunteer work in AIDS community services. And so I recall the time when protease inhibitors and more advanced treatments became available to people. And then people actually began to think about AIDS as a survivable disease. But, of course, when that story is set, it's set specifically in that year because at that time, as you say, AIDS has been a death sentence. So for that character who's dealing with HIV positive seroconversion, as it will be called, it is a much more dire reality for him then than it would be today.
And what has the response been to the book so far? I noticed it's been out since February 1st. How has it been received?
I didn't quite hear that. Say that once again, please.
I was saying, I've noticed the book has been out since February 1st of this year, and I was wondering how it had been received.
It's actually been out since December 1st of 2008. That's the official publication date, yeah.
Oh, okay. Is it the paperback?
But from what I can see, you know, it's always very interesting with the seeing how people react to what I've done, because there are so many different readers for these books from so many different places, and they read them in very different ways, but people also review them in very different ways, depending on where they come from. And I find that really interesting. So far, people seem to be enjoying the stories. I mean, as you say, they're diverse in approach and theme. So there's something perhaps for a wide palette of tastes. And I think that as with my first book of fiction, people found their favorites, as you have perhaps found yours. You know, and I think that these things alter and change over time. But so far, people have been very receptive, and I've had very nice reactions and readings that I've done around the country and so on. And I have more readings to come, so we'll see what happens in the weeks to come.
And what can people do? How can they go about getting your book?
Oh, well, they can buy the book certainly online. I recommend that people buy the book online at citylights.com, citylights.com, which is the actual publisher of the book, City Lights Publishers in San Francisco. They can also order it through local bookstores, and it might be in stock in many bookstores indeed as well. And so these days, of course, more people are buying on the Internet, but I encourage people to go to independent bookstores whenever possible and try to patronize independent bookstores. And for those who finances are a problem, of course, the book is available in many libraries or can be ordered through libraries as well. It's available pretty much, as far as I know, throughout the English-speaking world and other places as well, as we've seen, as I've seen on the Internet. I did readings in England, and it was available there, of course, and in Canada when I first began my tour in January. So it's available in a lot of places, and if it's not there, people can ask for it.
Great, and before we let you go, what are you currently working on now? Is there, are we going to see another book from you here in the near future?
Oh, indeed, yes. If I have anything to say about it, yeah. And I'll just say that I'm working on two books right now, in fact, and I do want to experiment again with nonfiction, as I did with my second book, but I also want to experiment with longer fiction, a longer fiction project, and I won't call it a novel, but that's probably what it's going to be, but that's what I'm experimenting with, working on, in fact, right now. So two books are in the offing, and I think that, I would say within the next couple of years, they'll be finished.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Thomas Glaive, author of The Torturer's Wife. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Joan, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a great night.
You too. You're listening to 90.1 KPFT FM Houston.
Thank you, Joan. That was Joan Devlin, our remote correspondent from Iowa, who does regular book reports for us, and she was talking to author Thomas Glaive. This is Queer Voices. from a 2007 CD that was Houston artist Miss Money, the title of the track Best Friend, and the name of the CD The Love of Money. This is Queer Voices.
Well, our party boy was out at a couple parties this week, huh?
Yes, I'm surprised he's here tonight, as a matter of fact.
I think I resent the party boy connotation, but community...
Well, if they could see you now, they could tell.
Oh. You're all tanned and everything.
Oh, yes.
It's totally fake. I did a spray on tan. You know, you got to look the part, though. No, but this weekend was...
you should have used a sprayer instead of a roller.
No, that's bad. No, this was a great weekend. Not only did they have Bunnies in the Bayou, which is kind of Houston's main outdoor cocktail party for Easter, but also a jungle party.
Yes.
Which was held the night before, and also the Lone Star Volleyball Association's tournament.
That's right. Somebody else went to that.
That's right. That's something that I'm involved in. So I was refereeing at that and also doing a lot of sort of administrative type stuff.
In other words, you were watching?
The paperwork. A lot of paperwork. Believe me. And but it was fun. It was a very good turnout. And I was saying that this year, this particular tournament went exceptionally well because... we didn't have any what are called protests, you know, where something happens on the court and there's a disagreement and you have to call the committee over and make a ruling about something. We didn't have any of that. And also, nobody died horribly.
Y'all but, just got along.
Exactly. You know, sometimes things happen, especially where you have extremely aggressive play like you might have on the AA court. Other years, you know, I mean, it did happen once. We actually had a broken bone. You know, somebody landed wrong and broke a femur. There were no sort of ambulance requiring injuries, so that was really good. That was notable, and we raised a lot of money for a good cause.
Well, good. What was the cause,
Brian?
That would be the Center for AIDS. I don't know how the connection happened, but
symbiosis here.
There you go. It's, you know, working together, community, you know, fundraisers and organizations.
The four of us and everybody out there.
Absolutely. Now, I know that the Bunnies were very worried about yesterday.
Because
the weather forecast was not on their side.
Frank Billingsley was saying doom and gloom, you know, big, large storms coming in, hail possible.
We were actually at the volleyball tournament, we were worried about it too, because initially they were talking about that rain was going to happen on Saturday. And in a really big industrial size facility like a gym that can handle 8 volleyball courts, you have these mercury vapor lamps, mm-hmm. right? Well, if there's the slightest power glitch, those lamps go out.
Right.
And you have to wait for up to 15 minutes for them mm-hmm. to cool down so they can restart.
Oh, right. Wow.
And that would have really put a cramp in our business.
That would have.
That had happened. Well, luckily, all the storms... delayed themselves until Sunday.
It was Sunday morning.
Well, you could have used the Sunday lighted morning, yeah. volleyball.
We normally like to use the volleyballs with the bell in it, you know, to wake people up. Right? But no. Okay. There's no bells of volleyball.
Yeah, there was a big storm Sunday morning.
Right. There was a single line. I saw it on the radar. There was just a single line of storms.
And just came and then yeah. just stormed. And then as if God had blessed Bunnies on the Bayou and the gays, the clouds parted and the sunlight shone.
Of course it did.
Yes, and it was a glorious day after that. So, there has to be something magical, I think.
That was wonderful, though. I mean, you know, we had that dark, gloomy morning,
mm-hmm.
and then the storms that rolled through around noonish, and then, it, you know, all of a sudden the sun came out in a clear blue sky.
You know, with the tournament, we had a whole bunch of people staying at a hotel out on, it was the Host Hotel out on the Southwest Freeway. And the hotel kind of put on a going away breakfast for us with little finger food sandwiches and not champagne. What do you call that? With it? Some mimosas.
Mimosas. Yeah,
and coffee and that sort of thing. And it was so dark, and then it was storming, you know, and people were saying, "Oh, I got to drive back to Dallas and all this." But I had seen the radar picture before I headed over there, and I said, "Don't worry, you know, this is all going to blow over in about 20 minutes, and then it'll be beautiful."
And it was. Totally blue, beautiful.
It was beautiful.
Not a cloud in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
It was a perfect day for Bunnies on the Bayou.
And all the gays came out, and it was glorious.
So how was it? What all went on?
Well, you know, it's the greatest, I guess, cocktail party in Houston, where, you know, it's kind of the C&BC crowd. You know, you come out, and you're you may be shirtless, or you may have some sort of nice outfit on.
They make me put my shirt back on.
Oh, they do? Well, that's just not right. And they've added a new thing in the last couple of years called Camp Bunny, where you have a sponsored tent, and then you kind of put in your own little decorations and everything. You have like a little open bar inside there.
Oh, okay.
And people come by, and they kind of judge each Camp Bunny. And, you know, they had some outrageous costumes and all kinds of crazy things. They had about 5 to 10 of those Camp Bunnies.
And this was, other than it was a nice big party, it also was to raise money for some very important things.
Yes, and I am not privy to the, I'm in the other organization in the Bayou City Boys Club, so I know their beneficiaries, but I don't know the bunnies on the Bayou beneficiaries. I do know that the Center for AIDS is one, and we appreciate that.
Yes. Those of you who were listening to our program last Monday can go to the archives and find out.
Or go to iTunes.
Yes.
But I can talk about Jungle and our
event. Talk about Jungle a second.
Yes, we have.
How were the costumes?
There were some interesting costumes, you know, kind of with the jungle theme. You kind of get all kinds of different jungle boys and, like, Tarzans and different things.
No jungle girls?
Fiona was dressed in jungle.
Oh, she was?
Yeah, she was looking kind of scandalous, I would say. I danced with her for a little while. She's crazy.
She's very sweet. Wonderful girl. But she is one of the Grand Marshals.
That's a good point. She is a Grand Marshal.
Because Pride is coming up, and it'll be upon us soon.
What day is that? It's like June 27th, I think.
It's the last full weekend in June.
Yes. On a Saturday.
And all of you know that that'll be at, the parade is at night, and of course the festival's during the day.
Absolutely. I love the nighttime aspect of it. I mean, that kind of makes the parade.
Well, Stonewall happened at night.
You know, I heard that it was started by a lesbian, not by a drag
trans
queen.
Drag queen?
Yeah. I heard it was started by a lesbian.
Well, of course. Probably a lesbian told you that.
No, it was actually the bartender who was at Stonewall the night it happened. I ran into him in New York, and he's still working as a bartender.
No kidding.
Yeah, at Stonewall. He's like, yeah, I was there that night.
How old is he now?
I would be nice and say... I'm being nice and saying maybe lower 60s, maybe. He's, you know...
I mean, fossilized?
Stonewall is... This is the 40th anniversary, right?
Right.
So if he was in his 20s, then...
Wait a minute. This is the 40th anniversary of Stonewall?
Yes. 40 years.
Yes, 69.
I went to New York for Stonewall 25, and it doesn't seem that long ago.
Well, 1969.
Time flies when you're having fun.
When you're having...
I guess so.
Yeah.
Fun. When you're getting old, time flies.
40 years.
Hey, since we're speaking of Pride... We should probably not mention that we are going to have what is at the moment a super secret fundraiser in association with Pride that's going to benefit.
We're working on it.
So we can't talk about it at all. We can't say anything about it.
It's a way of showing your support for
Queer Voices.
But it's going to be fabulous, and it's
we're putting it together. We're kind of making it a fun.
And it's all kind of secret right now.
It's yeah. We
and
can't.
So we can't talk about it.
We can't divulge details. But please stay tuned to Queer Voices. Also, as soon as we make it a formal announcement, it will be on Facebook.
And there's a lot of opportunities to find out what's going on, not only right now but in the future on our Facebook.
Which if you see that on Facebook, you can go. Do a search on Queer Voices, and you'll find the group, and you can join that way. We have 246 members now, and I'd like to get that to 300, you know, or more.
Yeah, you can go to queervoices.org, and then there's a link there to Facebook, and there's a link to Twitter. And
I am so proud of our show. I think we're the only show on KPFT that I know of that has both Facebook and Twitter.
I would bet the Technology Bites show.
Tech Bites,
also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we're the only gay one.
Well, there you go.
Well, one of the things I was just going to mention that next week in the first hour, we will be interviewing Rose Wall, who is president of the Houston Transgender Unity Committee, and Scott Turner Schofield, who is the entertainer and keynote speaker at the annual Transgender Unity Banquet that will be held on May 2nd. So if y'all want to be there... You can go online check it out and come. Schofield is a performance artist, female to male.
Which seems like the harder way to go.
Yes, there's. I would read some of the names on this, but I'm afraid that I think it's one of the seven deadly words that we can't say.
Oh, yeah.
But there is one, becoming a man in 127 easy steps.
That seems like a long way to go.
That is a very funny skit. And I've seen clips of it on...
I think it's on Logo.
It's on Logo. And I think there was a clip on YouTube, but I won't swear to that. You can find it if you want to. You can Google... I got the information in the bio on Scott Turner Schofield off the internet, so that there were a lot of links to the different presentations.
And don't forget that Queer Voices has a presence on Twitter, and I have that open, and I'm entering information as the show proceeds about the music that we're playing and the guests that we have on.
You're tweeting.
I'm tweeting.
If you're on Twitter, then go do a search on Queer Voices, and then click follow us. And that's how they can follow our updates.
Yes. And if all else fails, you can go to the archives at kpft.org. Click the archives, go to our time slot, and you can either listen to the shows and past shows or download it for later listening.
And if you are privy to iTunes, you can find us there on a podcast. If you do a search on Queer Voices iTunes, and you can subscribe, and then it will automatically download to your iPod or to your iPhone.
Whoa. And you can hear us every week, anytime you want.
And you'll be sure not to miss it.
Absolutely. Right.
It's very important that you do not miss a single show of Queer Voices.
Of course.
Absolutely not.
Yes, yes.
I mean, if you want to stay informed in the GOBT community here in Houston, this is the only way to go, I would say.
We're going to have to get to this next piece so that we can Twitter on out of here.
Tweet
on.
We have to tweet out.
That's right. We're going to tweet. This is kind of an audio tweet we just did, right?
That's it. It's Queer Voices.
Here's the rest from This Way Out.
Singer, songwriter, activist, boxer. That's right. John Lennon International Songwriting Grand Prize winner Bettina Schelker also holds the Swiss National Women's Middleweight Boxing title. She doesn't pull any punches when it comes to her politics either. Her partner under Switzerland's same-gender unions law is former pro basketball player Ina Nicosia Schelker, another force to be reckoned with. This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend chatted with the pair about their relationship and what inspired the title cut of Schelker's current CD, The Honeymoon Is Over.
I know two brides and both were white, one ring is all I have. I am so excited, but I haven't yet decided where to go.
And your music.
I've been a professional musician for about 10 years, so I make my living with music, and I write my own songs, and I travel the world with it. I run my own music label. I've been working on it for 10 years as well. I just play all the time and all over the world.
Your song, The Honeymoon Is Over, won the grand prize in the John Lennon International Songwriting Contest.
Well, in Switzerland, the law passed that same-sex people can get married. Yeah, it passed in 2005. Ina, my wife, and I started to plan the event really like more than a year ahead, and we planned our honeymoon. We went to travel agencies, but nobody wanted to give us a honeymoon special. I was really disappointed, and I started to do more research about in what countries homosexuality is illegal, and with all these researches and my own experience, I thought I have to write this song.
Well, you're also a boxing champion, and you just started your own school with sports and music. Tell us about that.
I got a phone call from a guy, he was a boxing coach, and he called and he said, do you know we organize these events called Boxeo? It's a combination between boxing fights and culture, like music or theater or dance. So they had this event and they were looking for a singer-songwriter because it was a jubileum, like 10 years of women's boxing. So I said, yes, I'm going to do it. That's fun. So I went there and I played really in the ring. The boxing club, they didn't have really money to pay me. They invited me for private lessons. They gave me gloves and bandages. And so I went there all by myself with a private coach. From the first hour I went there, I loved it. They let me do a fight and I won. I realized that I have talent. Yeah, then I thought, I want to become the Swiss boxing champion. This is like, I wanted to reach that.
Are you undefeated at this time?
Yeah.
All right.
Wow. Yeah, I'm undefeated. In Switzerland, we have a different school system. We don't have that much sports anyway at schools. When it gets cut, we have like 1 hour a week. My friends, they say, oh, our children don't have enough sports and music at school. And then we thought, well, if nobody does it, we have to do it. And we can. Yeah, we started this with a preschool, and we just got another license for a kindergarten, and we have over 100 children so far, and our goal is really to build it up to primary school.
You've recently done a world tour. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, musically, it was the best experience I ever had. When we were renting a car, it was really always a fight that we didn't have to pay for an extra driver. We married here in Switzerland, but in America, it's when we go and rent a car, they say, you have to pay for an extra driver. But as a married couple, you wouldn't have to do that.
Hi, Ina. What do you feel like whenever you hear about the queer scene in the United States now and all the issues we've been having against same-sex marriage at Prop 8 and all that?
It just honestly makes me sick, the whole Prop 8 thing. It really makes me sick to my stomach. But Tina had a U.S. tour in November, December, and we went completely cross-country from East Coast to West Coast. And kind of half of the reason I booked her shows on the West Coast was the finale was we were going to get married in California. And then in November, just kidding, you don't have the right anymore. So it was kind of a personal thing for us as well, because we're married here, we have the same last name. And then when we go there, it's not recognized.
Do you find living in Europe is better psychologically, being away from all the negativity of American homophobia?
When I first moved over, I had the American mentality where maybe I didn't want to hold hands in public, or my first couple of teaching jobs, I wasn't out to the students or the parents or anything for fear that, you know, suddenly because you're gay, that means you're a pedophile or something. And I, you know, didn't want anyone to, you know what I mean?
Like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Once in 2005 when this law passed and we decided that we were going to get married, that it was a breath of fresh air. It felt like a big weight was lifted off of my chest, because now I have rights here. And if somebody were to question my integrity, or if somebody were to make some kind of statements against me for whatever, I'm protected here now. Now we own this school, and from day one when parents come in, we introduce each other as our partners. You know, we don't hide it at all, and we have not had any negative feedback.
Bettina, your CD, The Honeymoon Is Over, reflects your political activism.
I started to become a political activist through my own story, and I really started to play a lot for campaigns for gay and lesbian rights, and especially gay marriage. But my opinion is, when you go out there and you live your life, if you are open, and this is my wife, when you start running, people can't chase you anymore. And this is actually, I think, the most valuable activism for equal rights.
Again, 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 again and again, 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 again and again, 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 again and again. Priorities, teachers, speeches, government speakers, people that wiggle, they might come free.
You've been listening to the title track from Bettina Schelker's CD, The Honeymoon Is Over, along with an interview with her and her wife, Anna Nicosia Schelker. Our thanks to correspondents Dixie Treichel and John Townsend.
Hi, I'm Jeff Marks, the creator of Avenue Q, the Broadway musical, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
The unexpected puppet musical smash hit Avenue Q will soon celebrate 6 years on Broadway, and its touring companies are performing all over the world. Gay tunesmith Jeff Marks won Tony Awards and was nominated for a Grammy. It's a record that's hard to top, but This Way Out entertainment correspondent Steve Pride was surprised to find out that none of that was ever part of Marks' career plan.
Hi, I'm Jeff Marks, the creator of Avenue Q, the Broadway musical.
So what's Avenue Q about?
It's very much about your expectations of what life is going to be, and then you move to New York, you think you're, you know, live in a great apartment in Midtown, and you find you can't afford it, and you got to live out, that's what Avenue Q is. Out in the East Village, there's Avenue A, B, C, D, and then it goes like all the way out into Brooklyn and Queens, Avenue E, F, G. We want to make it as far away as possible from Midtown where you actually want to be, and this was all us and our friends living out in Astoria and Greenpoint and you know, having to change trains a couple times to get into New York.
I don't know how I know, but I'm gonna find my purpose. I don't know where I'm gonna look, but I'm gonna find my purpose.
So how did Jeff Marks find his purpose?
I was a musical theater performance major in college, University of Michigan, and I wanted to perform, and they basically told me I had no talent and that I'd never make it as a performer. So I wanted to stay in theater, so I went to law school, and I thought I'll be an entertainment lawyer and represent theater people and eventually produce theater. So after going through law school, learning, you know, what I could about entertainment law and passing the bar in New York, I was a young lawyer looking for clients and realized that, you know, if I went and knocked on Barbara Streisand's door and said, hey, I'm a lawyer, can I represent you? She and everyone else with a career would say, thanks, I already have a lawyer, and that I should go where the young kids who are just developing their talents are. And so I joined this songwriting workshop, and I met all these young songwriters who were attracted to this great, great program, the BMI Workshop, and I thought they're going to be tomorrow's Broadway, have, you know, the careers on Broadway. So I went into this workshop just as a lawyer looking for clients, but I had to write songs every week like everybody else, and I met Bobby, and we started a class project together. We thought, what are we going to write? You know, we needed to create a project. So we thought about the Muppets, and we thought about Sesame Street, and we thought about how I was out of law school, he was out of Yale, all of our friends were out of like Ivy League schools and temping and answering phones and you know, getting coffee and stuff, and how ridiculous it was that our expectations of the world after college was not matching up with the opportunities that, you know, we thought we were going to come out and set the world on fire, and instead you're getting coffee and answering, you know, phones when the receptionist's on break, and temping and interning, and yeah, and we thought it was funny, so we wrote, basically created a show about us and our friends and our, you know, how our lives sucked.
Avenue Q is the most gay positive show on Broadway.
Oh, hi, Rod!
Hi, Nikki.
Hey, Rod, you'll never guess what happened to me on the subway this morning. This guy was smiling at me and talking to me.
Mm, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
He was being real friendly, and I think he was coming on to me. I think he might have thought I was gay.
So why are you telling me this? Huh? Why should I care? I don't care. What'd you have for lunch today?
But even though Rod is secretly in love with his roommate, Nikki, he's still in the puppet closet.
That was very much my story, especially in the musical theater program at Michigan where, you know, they're all actors. It was a very permissive, open atmosphere, and there were a lot of gay students, but not me. I mean, I was gay, but didn't, you know, was very ashamed and didn't want to talk about it. And I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood where we just didn't know any gay people. There were no gay people that I knew of in my high school. And the only gay models that we had were Rock Hudson, Liberace, and my mom's hairdresser. So it wasn't a real welcoming atmosphere. And I was very afraid that if I even tried to tiptoe out and explored, you know, what I was attracted to at all, that people were going to be like, ah, gay, 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 we knew it, you know, and force me out of the closet before I was ready. So my journey is very much reflected in Rod.
All those nights I lay in bed, thoughts of you running through my head.
I know, put my earmuffs on the cookie.
But I never thought the things in my head could really happen in my bed.
You look like David Hasselhoff.
All those years I missed the signs, couldn't read between would see the day where I'd hear you say what I heard you say. And now I find what was always in my mind was in your mind too. Oh, you, fantasies come true.
It opened '03. It was a tiny little 120-seat theater off Broadway, and we thought we had died and gone to heaven. I never meant to be a songwriter. You know, I joined this songwriting workshop. I met a collaborator, a class project, just went all the way to a nonprofit off-Broadway theater. And we thought, oh my God, we got a show off-Broadway. We were in the New York Times, and the New York Times actually gave it such a glowing, wonderful review, comparing it to West Side Story, of all things. You know, as far as being groundbreaking, that it became the hot ticket. And, like, you know, there were 120 seats, and every performance there were just more people in the lobby hoping for cancellation than there were actually, you know, seats in the theater. So our producers, in their infinite wisdom, decided we need to move this to a bigger theater. We think there's a demand for it. People are loving it. Let's try our hand on the big stage. And it worked, and it won the Tony Awards that year, and for the two writing awards for score and script, and best musical. We beat Wicked. It surprised the hell out of everyone.
Could part of the show's success be because there's a lot of puppet nudity?
Not a lot. I mean, there's a puppet sex scene. Of course, a lot of it is imagined because they're like Muppets. They're only waist up. So there's no genitals. It's all in the imagination of our dirty audiences.
So this is your story,
but without genitals.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. That aspect was fictional. You know, we have genitals.
I've heard that your writing partner, Bobby Lopez, has a significant musical theater handicap.
But yeah, no, he's married and has kids and he's straight. People always assumed he was gay. Actually, our agent, when he sent us out on meetings, he usually used to say the one that seems gay is actually straight and the one that seems straight is actually gay. which he wasn't very pleased about that setup. Our director was gay, our book writer was gay, two of our three producers were gay, you know. A lot of our actors are gay. I mean, it's theater.
This has been a conversation with Avenue Q co-creator Jeff Marks. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
If you were gay, that'd be okay. I mean, 'cause hey, I'd like you anyway. Because you see, if it were me, I would feel free to say that I was gay, but I'm not gay.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Chris Wilson, Rex Walkman with Bill Kelly, Dixie Trykle and John Townsend, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KDHX St. Louis, Missouri, 2BBB Bellingen, New South Wales, WBCR Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
On April 18th, Emerson Unitarian Universalist Church will present an Earth Day benefit concert of Paul Winter's Missa Gaia for KPFT. The music combines sounds of nature, including whale songs, the cry of tundra wolves, birdsong, and the voices of harp seals with instrumentalists and vocalists performing jazz, African, Brazilian, gospel, and New Age music. Admission is free, and an offering will be taken to benefit KPFT and Emerson's Ministry for Earth. The concert begins at 7:30 p.m. on April 18th. Emerson Unitarian Universalist Church is located at 1900 Bering Drive. Contact the church at 713-782-8250 or emersonhouston.org. Missa Gaia brought to you by Emerson Unitarian Universalist Church and 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Come see the Texas premiere of a film on Indian music, Raga Unveiled. Raga Unveiled is a beautiful film that brings alive the artistry and origins of India's raga music. Commentaries by musicians and scholars are woven together with an amazing spectrum of sound and rare archival footage. The showing is on Sunday, May 17th from 3 to 5:30 p.m. at the Rice Media Center, Rice University. Free parking is available in selected lots.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.